Under the watchful eyes and gun barrels of Bridget and Grant, the uninjured hellhound, a middle-aged man named Glupp, dragged the bodies out of the building. Kane and Skydog stared somberly at Carthew during the procedure, who stared back just as somberly. The two men had been stripped of their magistrate body armor and wore only their black undersheathings of Kevlar weave. Although the fabric was tough, it wouldn't turn a bullet or even a bladed weapon wielded with sufficient force. Perched on a chair, arms wrapped around his torso, the former leader of the Hellhounds coughed occasionally, bringing up red-hued phlegm. Carthew discreetly spit on the floor, a small indication that he was willing to bargain for his life. Otherwise, he would have spit at his captors. Outside, twilight had swiftly deepened into a full, impenetrable night. Before moonrise, visibility was limited to only a few feet. Glupp had laid the bodies out by the riverbank, but there wasn't enough time or stones to build decent cairns. The wolves and coyotes would finish the job he started. Skydog lit the animal fat lanterns, which shed a sickly yellowish glow and exuded a foul stench, a combination of old grease and rotting meat. Kane gingerly massaged his throbbing right hand.
Looks like we're back to where we started.
More or less. Like you already know, we have an arrangement with the Millennial Consortium. They give us what we need to operate, and we give them what they need.
Which is slave labor?
That and anything else useful we found in the convoys. Tools, food, clothing.
They sure as hell didn't give you those motorcycles.
We found the bikes in the Cobaltville Armory. They were stored in pieces. When me and my crew lit out, we took everything that we could cram into a sandcat or tie onto the outside.
Why'd you cut and run? With your ambition, seems like you would have proclaimed yourself the Grand Wazoo.
Don't think I didn't try, but I wasn't the only one with that idea. There were too many factions shooting at each other. Allies one day, enemies the next, everybody switching sides, cutting dirty deals with competitors. You know what it's like there. Fun and games, man. Fun and games.
Yeah, so we heard.
Heard how?
We have our ways.
Kane referred to the eavesdropping system Cerberus had established through the communications link-up with the ComSat satellite. It was the same system and same satellite used to track the subcutaneous biolink transponder signals implanted within the Cerberus personnel. Everyone in the redoubt had been injected with a transponder that transmitted not just their general locations, but heart rate, respiration, blood count, and brainwave patterns. Based on organic nanotechnology, the transponder was a non-harmful radioactive chemical that bound itself to an individual's glucose and the middle layers of the epidermis. The signal was relayed to the redoubt by the ComSat, one of the two satellites to which the installation was uplinked. Bry, the resident tech head of Cerberus, had worked on the eavesdropping system for a long time and had managed to develop an undetectable method of patching into the wireless communications channels of all the baronies in one form or another. The success rate wasn't 100%, but Cerberus had been able to eavesdrop on a number of the Vills and learn about Baron-sanctioned operations in the Outlands. The different frequencies were monitored on a daily basis, and over the past 6 months they had heard little from the Vills, aside from sporadic reports of pure chaos.
How do you exchange goods with the Millennialists?
For an instant, the old Magistrate arrogance glinted in Carthew's single eye. He didn't like being questioned by a man he considered one of the lesser breeds, but his ego didn't get the better of his sense of self-preservation.
The Crazy Woman. That's the name of the barge out there. We sail down to a rendezvous point and make our trades.
While Carthew spoke, Bridget peered into the ditch, cut into the dirt floor, leaning over with her hands resting on her knees.
What do you get out of it? Never mind. I think I see it.
See what?
Climbing down into the trench, Bridget stretched her left arm into a space, groped for a few moments, and then straightened. A small rectangular object in her hand reflected the lamplight.
This is what's known as an aha moment.
What have you got there, Baptiste?
Bridget held the object out to Kane, who crossed to her and took it.
See for yourself. There's at least 100 more in this homemade vault.
A brightly polished gold ingot gleamed in Kane's hand. Even in the dim light, Kane made out the words U.S. Mint embossed on its surface.
Now I get it. You traded human lives for gold?
That's the way of the world, Chief. With enough gold, I can buy myself a position of authority somewhere. either in a barony or a settlement.
And be a baron yourself. Is that the plan?
Being a hellhound was a strictly temporary proposition. It's not like I had a lot of job security, only a means to an end.
You expect us to believe that the Millennial Consortium is running a gold mine in the Bighorns?
Bridget climbed out of the hole.
No. This is pre-dark. The ore smelted and refined.
Kane tossed the gold bar to Skydog for inspection.
You've been pretty quiet, Glup. Why don't you contribute something to the discussion?
Glup shifted in his chair uncomfortably, casting a questioning glance at Carthew.
Why are you looking at him? We're the ones you need to please.
We don't exactly know what they're doing up there. They never let us travel much past the rendezvous point. Benedict Snow calls the shots, not us.
Shut up, Glup.
No, talk it up, Glup. I'm starting to feel better, and that's a good thing for you.
The Millennialists never told us what they're doing. I talked to a couple of Snow's grunts one time, and they said they found a wheel or something inside the damn mountain.
A wheel inside? A medicine wheel?
No, not that kind of wheel. A wheel that works with a machine.
A cogwheel?
Yeah, that's it. A cogwheel.
What the hell is he talking about?
Cog. C-O-G. Continuity of government. The Millennial Consortium has found a cog facility inside Medicine Mountain.
Discovering a cog base would explain the gold bar, since we know the places were used for storage. But that doesn't tie in with the consortium's activities in Carver's Cave, unless there was a cog facility there, too.
Not likely, since Redoubt Tango is only a few miles away.
The redoubt to which she referred was located about 35 miles to the southwest of Ragnarville. Before the new cost, the Tango installation had served as the Totality Concept's research center into new forms and applications of cryonic science.
Glup, you know something you're not telling us.
Yeah, but it's just stuff I heard the grunts talking about. Crazy crap about magic and changing the world with it.
Did they mention the Taimei?
Taimei? Not that I recollect.
Tawassi?
Don't ring a bell.
Baycock?
Nope.
Catamount?
You know that sick bitch.
We're asking the questions. You know her, Glup?
Yeah, kinda. Her and her Lynx soldiers. Catamount and them kill-crazy sluts were at the first rendezvous we had with Snow. I don't like talking about what happened.
Why not? Did a hellhound get overly familiar with her and she humiliated one of you big bad ex-mags?
Merrick, one of my men, put his hands on her. I mean, why not? She was walking around damn near naked, acting like she was too high and mighty for us. In about 5 seconds, the slut had him down on the ground. She took a knife and... It happened so goddamn fast. 1 second she was knocking Merrick down, the next second his balls was in her hand. Then while he was screaming, she cut out his tongue. Then she scalped him and crammed his own hair, tongue, and balls in his mouth to shut him up.
That's gotta smart.
Merrick went into shock. Bled to death.
I stayed aboard the boat at all the other rendezvous after that. Didn't want to risk running into her.
Can't say as I blame you. I'd want to stay out of her way, too.
Staying out of her way might not be as easy as it used to be. She and her Lynx soldiers act as the Consortium Security Squad. They've been extending the range of their patrols the last few days, coming into the Flatlands.
Why?
Probably looking for you.
How do you arrange a rendezvous with the Consortium?
We load up the barge and take it downriver about 10 miles to a little sand spit near a waterfall. We signal with flares. After a couple of hours, the Millennialists meet us.
Sounds simple enough.
Yeah. So simple, you probably expect us to guide you there.
Very perceptive. You're not as stupid as I thought you were. I'll bet you're astute enough to guess when all of us will be leaving, too.
First thing in the morning?
Kane glanced out the window and saw that a three-quarters moon shone brightly above the treetops, casting a silvery illumination over the terrain.
It looks like there's enough light for you to get back to the Kit Foxes and fetch them here, Skydog, and all of our equipment. I have a feeling we'll need it.
I'll get right on it.
The shaman nodded and stepped toward the door.
Well, how about letting me go a little ways with you?
Yeah, that'll happen.
Suit yourself. But there's no facilities in the place, if you get my drift. I'm guessing you plan on staying the night inside here just to keep from freezing to death. But hey, if you don't mind the stink, neither do I.
All right.
Kane unholstered his second pistol, holding it in his left hand.
But you're walking on your own, and if I get even a half-assed idea that you're up to something other than...
I've had enough violence for the time being, Kane. My day turned to shit early, and it's going to end the same way.
The one-eyed man preceded Skydog and Kane outside. The air was sharp and cold, very refreshing after the stink of the trading station. The moon shone bright in the sky, and Kane's sight adjusted to take in every detail of the silver-splashed clearing around the building. Carthew walked slowly, still bent over. Kane prodded him with the barrel of the Bren 10, guiding him toward the outhouse. From the corner of his eye, he caught a brief, almost subliminal flicker of movement in the brush bordering the perimeter. He grabbed Carthew.
Hold it.
Skydog and Carthew stopped. Kane visually probed the shadows beneath and between the trees.
Look, goddammit, I really have to go.
Carthew staggered, a long feathered shaft sprouting from his left eye socket, and about an inch of wet, red, razor-sharp metal jutting out from the back of his head.
Fuck.
Skydog and Kane crouched beside Carthew, eyes and gun barrel questing for a target. A woman came riding out of the tree line astride a great black mare. She wore the pelt of a cougar like a hooded cape. Her bare breasts bounced in cadence with the rhythm of the horse's gallop. A huge panther loped alongside her horse, its eyes shining with an eerie green-yellow luminosity.
Catamount!
Kane stared at her, rooted to the spot in astonishment. Skydog's description of the woman had not even hinted at her savage beauty, or the way a tigerish flame of force seemed to burn within her. He saw that her eyes were big and brown under level brows, with a bold nose and finely sculptured curve of cheek and chin. She was taller than he expected, longer and leaner of limb than was usual for Amerindian women. Firm of bosom, there was no trace of softness underlying her feminine curves. She moved with the smooth grace of her namesake. Wielding a crossbow, Catamount was a fierce Amazon warrior, a Valkyrie, a chooser of the slain. Behind her rode a half dozen other women, all young and lean-muscled, copper-skinned, their black hair plaited into long braids hanging down their shoulders. Like Catamount, they were bare-breasted, fur-kirtled, and wearing boot moccasins. They carried long, slender spears and small, round, rawhide shields.
Shoot her! Kill her now, Unktomi Shunkaha!
Unktomi Shunkaha!
Catamount and the Lynx soldiers thundered into the trees and out of sight. The panther paused a moment, then it too vanished into the darkness. Skydog stood up, fists clenched, his fierce obsidian eyes glinting with anger.
You should have killed her when you had the chance, Unktomi Shunkaha. Now that she has put a face to your name, she will add your scalp to her coups. It will be a great honor for her.
Kane glanced down at the motionless form of Carthew and swallowed down bile.
She'll have to work hard for it.
Make no mistake, she wouldn't have it any other way.
The first rays of the morning sun slanted over the crazy woman's gunwales. Kane drew a deep breath of the frigid air into his lungs. There was something exhilarating about the post-daybreak chill, about watching dawn arrive and drive away the streamers of damp mist hanging among the trees. Kane had only half slept the night before, tossing about on the hard floor, clutching at a blanket, his nerves jangling. His dreams were full of fragmented images of naked women turning into ferocious spitting cats. He awoke at 3:30, shivering, despite the thermal controls of his shadow suit. The chill of the earth and the nearby river worked through him, settling into every one of his old wounds. His right wrist ached abominably, as if the panther he had glimpsed the night before had sunk its fangs into the marrow. The bones had been fractured a few years before by exposure to an infrasound wand, and the bullet fired by the Colt Cobra, even deflected by his Bren 10, had aggravated the injury. He had gotten off lucky, although the auto pistol was damaged beyond repair. Still, Kane always enjoyed getting away from the vanadium-sheathed confines of the Cerberus Redoubt. He took keen pleasure in exploring new lands, which made him an exception among the Redoubt's residents. Time within the huge tri-level installation was measured by the controlled dimming and brightening of lights to simulate sunrise and sunset. Since most of the people were either vil-bred or had lived in artificial environments for many years, they didn't mind the electronic changeover from dawn to dusk. Rarely had any of them strayed more than a few miles from the redoubt's mountain plateau, even the emigres from the Menetius moon colony. The more crowded the redoubt became, the less satisfied Kane felt to stay there for any length of time. The pull of adventure, of exploring the remote places, grew stronger with every passing day. Despite the sense of danger, he also experienced a profound sense of peace while in the wild regions. Kane took in the panorama of the wide river cutting through the rocky country on both sides of them. He gazed at a line of cliffs about 3 miles ahead. The early morning mist half hid them, wreathing the summits in wispy white. Kane glanced over at Grant, who was testing the gimbal of a GEC minigun on its upright swivel mount. The multiple bored barrel of the weapon protruded between slabs of abbreviated but thick steel shielding. According to Glupp, the heavy machine gun had been appropriated from a Cobaltville blockhouse as he and his companions fled the barony. It was one of the rifle-caliber versions that had been used in the Ville's checkpoints. Standing in the stern, Glupp manned the big tiller as he expertly piloted the barge down the center of the river. It was about 1,000 feet from bank to bank at that point, the fast current foaming white all around the hull. The kit foxes sitting on crates around the deck didn't look comfortable. Canoeing across placid lakes or hugging the shorelines of streams was one thing, but they were plainsmen and didn't trust large bodies of water, particularly one as wide and wild as the Powder River. Glupp seemed cheerful, despite losing all of his comrades and commander the day before. Kane figured he had never been happy as either a mag or a hellhound, and exulted in a newfound sense of freedom. The man turned more forthcoming after the death of Carthew, explaining that the Millennial Consortium had built its own defense perimeter around the rendezvous point.
What's the extent of their defenses?
You mean arms and men? Hell, I really couldn't say. But I'm pretty sure they got a large boat of their own, and the guys I did see were well armed. I'm not talking home-forged muzzle loaders here. I mean well-maintained automatic weapons. And you gotta figure Cantamount's raised a general alarm by now.
Why did she have it in for Carthew?
You got me. If I had to guess, I'd say to keep him from betraying the Millennialists to enemies.
She acted like she recognized my name.
So you said. Your buddy Skydog seemed to think that was because damn near everybody had heard of the deeds of Trickster Wolf.
Kane doubted Skydog's answer. He suspected Catamount's recognition of him, or his name, was more than just a sign of celebrity. Bridget Baptiste stood portside amidships, scanning the distant bank with her binoculars. Skydog stood next to her, doing the same thing, pointing out objects of interest. Kane felt a quick, irrational flash of jealousy. He chided himself for his childishness and returned his attention to the river ahead. Grant finished his examination of the GEC.
Hey, Glupp, how much farther?
Not very. Another 3 or 4 miles. We'll make a damn good time.
I wish I knew if that was good or bad.
I suppose that depends on what we're sailing into.
Folks, we got some rough water coming up. Stay away from the sides, lest you feel like taking a cold bath.
Taking out his own binoculars, Kane gazed at the river and country stretching ahead of the bow. The Powder River began narrowing steadily, and as it did so, the swiftness of the current increased. The barge bounced on the increasingly rough water as it entered a bottleneck. White-capped rapids splashed violently around rocks thrusting up from the river bottom. The concourse cut through gigantic tumbles of granite and basalt, huge boulders that had fallen from the cliffs due to the monster quakes of the new coast. The rock formations were split by small inlets and channels drawing away from the main waterway. Many of them were clotted by thickets of brown, thorny brush. In the distance, a dark, looming shape resolved into sharper detail, a broad waterfall spreading like a translucent veil over the face of a cliff. Kane's point man's sense flared at the first glimpse of it, but he was too preoccupied with not pitching overboard to give it much thought. For the next minute or so, the barge bobbed and swung sideways in the current, the rubber tires roped to the hull, cushioning it from the glancing collision with rocks. Then the river channel widened and the current gradually slowed.
Pretty calm sailing from here on. You can relax.
Grant rested his hand on the butt of the Colt Cobra he had appropriated from the dead man at the trading station. The heavy revolver was secured in a gun belt and holster.
Yeah, that's what we'll do, all right. We all feel like just kicking back and relaxing.
Kane scarcely heard him. His attention was completely absorbed in watching the river ahead of the crazy woman. The water frothed under the keel as she breasted the quick-flowing channel. It turned and twisted amid sand spits and patches of thicket so that he could not see clear water ahead for more than 100 yards. At the next bend, Kane saw how the river was shadowed by overarching trees. In the tangled leafless boughs, nothing stirred but a flock of birds taking frantic flight, but he didn't spy anything that could have set them to wing. Kane saw the thicket on the port side spit a tongue of flame and caught a fragmented glimpse of a quick darting streak. The hit shook the crazy woman's frame and popped Cork up from between the deck planks. One of the kid foxes fell overboard, tumbling headfirst into the water. He surfaced once, already pushed yards away from the barge by the current, turning and flailing in a mad thrash of arms and legs. Then he was swept around a half-submerged boulder and was gone.
Shit!
Up ahead, Kane saw a wall of shrubbery far too green for the winter-brown thickets, and he realized the barge was fast approaching a foliage-masked weapons battery.
See? What I tell you! They were waiting for us!
Grant ducked into the wheelhouse and dragged out the plastic case that held the log.
Shut up! You didn't say anything about this kind of reception.
Kane crouched on the heaving deck, pistol in hand.
Skydog, get your men to return the fire. Best east.
I know what to do!
Bridget ran across the deck, taking up a position at the GEC, crouching behind the shielding.
Fire in the hole!
Kane glanced over his shoulder as flame and smoke gouted from the hollow bore of the missile launcher. Propelled by a wavering ribbon of vapor and sparks, the heat round leaped from the tube. The warhead impacted in a thicket, the brush vanishing in a roiling ball of billowing orange-yellow flame.
Blow astern!
That one hit us below the waterline! Faster than two rocket launchers!
A bullet hit the pilot house just an inch shy of Kane's left shoulder. He turned aft, seeing two of the Lakota down and bleeding on the deck. Then aimed his Sin-Eater at the sniper's position. Kane fired in a steady roll at the shapes hunkered down atop the rocks, the bullets chiseling dust-spurting notches in the stone. Four men wearing identical gun-colored shirts and pants rose to their knees, rifles at their shoulders. Kane put the Sin-Eater's sights over one of the men and squeezed the trigger. The bullet slammed through his head, jerking him sideways and throwing him against the man beside him. Kane squeezed off another round, then flung himself backward behind the shield of the corner of the pilot house. Bullets crashed into it, tearing away long splinters. Bridget swiveled the GEC toward them, breaking the boulders with a jackhammering ferocity, geysers of dust and stone shards flying in all directions. Rounds from the heavy machine gun clawed open the torso of one of the men from sternum to groin. As he fell, doubled up into the river, his companion slid down the opposite side of the boulder and out of sight.
Bluff, where the hell is this rendezvous point of yours?
Bluff took his right hand away from the wooden tiller long enough to point urgently ahead. Kane turned just as the crazy woman swept around a bend. A wide sand spit projected out into the water, cutting the river's width at that point to less than 50 feet. Stretching out from the tip of the spit, Kane saw that the channel was blocked by a double row of dead trees and timber.
Pull astern!
Fire in the hole!
Grant fired the log again. The rocket streaked across the surface of the water, pushing ripples ahead of it. As the warhead struck the bank, the blast swept away the thicket as if by a giant scythe. Four dun-colored figures then plunged through the smoke and flame like disjointed marionettes. There was no answering fire.
I think we managed to fight them off.
The crazy woman backtracked clumsily away from the barrier, the GEC still blazing. The rifle fire from the banks had tapered off since the detonation of the Law's warhead. Rising to his feet, Kane ran across the slippery deck to the stern, helping Bluff wrestle the tiller around. Through the smoke drifting over the surface of the water, Kane and Bluff both saw a dark shape shove out into the river from one of the side channels, right across the barge's course, and nearly 1,000 yards away. They caught only a fragmented glimpse of a mass of foliage triced up all around the gunwales and the bow, as well as a long, fluted metal cylinder.
Whoa! Shit!
The shell left the long barrel. Trailing a plume of smoke, the warhead vectored in on its target.
Move it!
Kane grabbed Bluff and dragged him away from the tiller. Kane was flung to the deck by an impact that knocked the breath from his body. His eyes were dazzled by a brilliant flash of fire as the shell exploded directly against the crazy woman's stern. Fragments of the paddle box and metal clattered down all around him. The rubber belt attached to the diesel engine's flywheel separated. Silently, Glupp lay on the deck beside him, folded around a 3-foot-long splinter ripped from the tiller. His intestines oozed out along the point of the bloody wood. His waxy face showed no real pain, only surprise. Then his expression became vacant, mouth hanging open slackly. Kane wasn't sure if he had passed out due to shock or died, but he had no time to make sure. Staggering to his feet, clinging to the rail, Kane blinked his eyes against the stinging smoke, trying to focus them on the gunboat that had lunged so suddenly from the side channel to cut off the crazy woman's withdrawal. The craft was small and black, lying low in the water to accommodate the 150-pound weight of the tripod-mounted HNK grenade machine gun. It fired 40-millimeter high-explosive rounds with a maximum reach of a mile.
Kane, are you all right?
Hell no, I'm not all right. We're about to be sunk!
Fire stabbed from the muzzle of the HNK again, and the grenade burst in a hellfire blossom close alongside the crazy woman, just behind the wreckage of the paddle box. As smoke streamed over the water, he saw the maddened Lakota leaping and bounding to return the fire with their rifles, their painted faces making them look like denizens of hell. Water spumed in little geysers all around the camouflaged gunboat, but because of its screen of foliage, they couldn't see if their shots found human targets. Bridget hunkered down behind the GDC and depressed the trigger. She swung it on its gimbals in short, left-to-right arcs, tongues of fire lapping from the spinning bores. Grant hastily reloaded the Law, a race between the HNK 40-millimeter grenade machine gun bolted to the black craft's bow and the swiftness with which he could achieve target acquisition. As he shoved the rocket into place, smoke and flame spit from the hollow bore of the HNK.
Brace yourselves! Shit!
Grant fell over backward, dropping the Law. The rocket within the launcher leaped from the bore and streaked into the wheelhouse. The opposite side of the wheelhouse burst open in a sleet storm of flinders and kindling. The open doorway vomited a cascade of flame, touching Grant.
God damn it!
Grant rolled frantically, his jacket smoldering. The deck was already awash with the Powder River, so his roll across it doused the flames. Although his shadow suit protected him from serious burns, he felt the sting of fire on his face. Scorched, dazed, he staggered erect at the rail. The crazy woman tilted astern. Hungry tongues of flame licked up through every crack in the planking, but the river streaming over the deck extinguished them, with puffs of steam combining with the smoke to form an almost impenetrable haze.
Grant!
I'm all right.
Bridget moved into sight, one hand on the side, the other pressing against her right hip. She grimaced as she walked, favoring her right leg. Grant reached out for her, but she waved him away.
I took a spill. Nothing broken. I hope.
A moment later, Kane, Sky Dog, and three of the Kid Foxes joined them. All were soaking wet and bedraggled, their face paint runny, their feathers drooping.
We're all that's left.
I'd say we've just been officially outsmarted and outgunned.
You helped a little bit in that area. That last rocket of yours pretty much took the bottom out of the crazy woman.
Oh yeah? Well,
we've got to get to shore, fast!
I don't see anybody, but they could be lying in wait for us.
Bridget swung a leg over the side of the boat.
It's not like we have any choice. Let's do it, not discuss it.
Grant hesitated. He wasn't much of a swimmer, a deficiency he had managed to conceal from Kane for the past 15 years. But over the side, into the river, was their one chance while they were still screened by the smoke. Otherwise, they would be either shot to pieces, burned to a crisp, or blasted apart if flames reached the crate of grenades in the shattered wheelhouse.
What the hell are you waiting for?
I am definitely too old for this shit.
Grant slid over the gunwale. He went deep, arms and legs threshing as he fought to get back to the surface. The water was bone-numbingly cold, but it felt good against the burned flesh of his face. His head rose up in the smoke-filtered sunlight. The heavy Colt Cobra dragged at his waist. He loosened the buckle of the gun belt and let it go, but he kept his copperhead. Just ahead of him, he saw Bridget and Kane swimming easily, steadily, for the sand spit. Farther ahead, he saw Sky Dog and the three surviving Kit Fox soldiers stroking in a neat crawl. He did his best to emulate their movements, fighting the current that tugged at him, pushing him toward the deadfall of fallen trees.
Fuck! Stop!
The flames had found the case of grenades before the barge sank. In a few more strokes, Grant's kicking feet hit the bottom and he stood up. Bridget and Kane waded ashore just ahead of him. Kane swung anxious eyes toward the crazy woman. The vast cloud of dark gray smoke spread out from the burning, sagging hulk. The smaller black craft, outfitted with a grenade machine gun, was not in sight. The seven people slogged onto the sand spit and stood for a moment.
God damn the luck! Son of a bitch!
I think we need to get out of sight before our luck improves any further.
I don't see how it could.
They sprinted across the open ground of the spit onto a narrow animal path running between heavy tangles of vegetation. Once away from the river among a copse of pines and ferns, the seven people stopped again to take inventory of their injuries and their possessions. Although none of them were hurt, all of them were stripped down to their bare essentials. Kane and Bridget had managed to retain their sidearms and copperheads, but they were down to one full clip of ammunition for each weapon. Grant had only his subgun and his 14-inch combat knife. The blades were part of his and Kane's standard field ordnance, so both men had them sheathed securely at their hips. Skydog and his Sioux saved only their edged weapons, knives and tomahawks, although the shaman's parflesh was still attached to his belt. Everything else, from their survival packs to the medical kit, had gone down with the crazy woman.
Well, we've been in worse situations with less than this.
When?
Shh, listen.
Crouching among the tree trunks, they peered through the ferns at the point of the sandspit. The black, flat-keeled boat pushed through the scraps of smoke. The camouflage of intertwined brush had been discarded, and they saw three men aboard. All of them were attired identically in dun-colored khaki uniforms, gun belts, and long-visored caps. Two of them stood on either side of the H&K grenade launcher mounted in the bow. The third man sat behind it, hand on the charger handle. The man on the left scanned the bank of the sandspit through binoculars. He inched them across the ground, paused, moved on, and then came back. He handed the glasses to the gunner. The man peered through the eyepieces, nodded, and then handed them back. He shifted position behind the H&K, squinting into the scope and making adjustments on the calibration knob.
They've spotted our tracks. We should have been more careful.
Since they didn't see our bodies floating in the river, then they'd assume this was the most likely place for us to have swum ashore. Erasing our footprints wouldn't have made any difference. Besides, these men aren't the grunts Glup said they were. They're professional. They know their jobs.
They watched in breathless silence, and the man peered through the scope, estimating elevation and angle, and pulled back on the H&K's charger handle. Everyone dropped flat as the grenade streaked overhead and struck the trunk of a tree several yards to their rear.
They can only have the most general idea of where we are.
Yeah, they can just shell the whole area until they drive us out.
Then let's get the hell out of range before they get too close.
Skydog began backing out on his hands and knees. As they followed Skydog's actions, suspicion and fear welled up within Kane in equal measure. Thus far, the consortium agents had shown themselves to be canny tacticians, allowing them to sail into a cul-de-sac before springing the trap and cutting off their retreat. The millennialists didn't seem to be the type to fire random shots at the trees in the hopes of flushing out their quarry like a flock of common quail. Kane's point man's sense sent out a constant alert, telling him that the men on the gunboat were hoping they would react exactly in the way they were. The Lakota and Cerberus warriors went deeper into the forest, wincing as the explosive rounds hit. Within a few minutes, they were clambering through ravines and climbing along ridges. Much to Skydog's irritation, Kane took the point, but not because he was more attuned to the wilderness. Walking point was a habit he had acquired during his years as a magistrate, and he saw no reason to abandon it. Both Bridget and Grant had the utmost faith in Kane's instincts. Over the next 2 hours, the sun rose higher in the sky, warming their chilled bodies and drying their clothes. They reached a treeless escarpment shortly before noon and stopped to rest and take their bearings. The blue-hazed height of Medicine Mountain loomed up from the horizon, surrounded by slate outcroppings, plateaus, and massive crags. The waterfall was much closer, less than 2 miles away as the crow flew. To reach it, the small party would have to descend into a shallow valley filled with rocks, scrub brush, and bordered by shrub and snarled pine trees. Bridget sat on a rock, shivering slightly and massaging her right hip. Grant stood, surveying the landscape.
Now I know what the word desolate means.
No sound. Not an animal or even a bird.
This is sacred land.
Yeah, sort of feels that way.
Bridget checked over her TP-9, and Grant quickly examined his copperhead and found their weapons in working condition.
Now what?
Kane saluted the lofty peaks of Medicine Mountain sharply.
Now we go there.
Although the three kit foxes didn't understand English, they easily gleaned the meaning of his gesture. Their trepidation was apparent.
The Kit Fox Society does not fear man or animal, but this is the land of the grandfather. They fear to trespass.
And are we not their grandchildren? We have come to drive away any trespassers, and so we must walk on the sacred ground ourselves. Our cause is just, and the grandfather will recognize that. He will reward, not punish us.
You've picked up Sioux warrior psychology pretty quickly. They're very angry and upset about losing our friends, and need some sort of motivator to go against conditioning and seek revenge.
I figured as much. Repeat what I said to them and see if it works.
Skydog took the three off a distance, where a brief and intense discussion followed. When they returned, the Lakota smiled in relieved gratitude at Bridget as if she had solved a knotty problem for them. Kane wished he could be so easily reassured. The feeling that they had willingly strolled into a trap increased with every passing second.
Where's the medicine wheel on the mountain?
Shading her eyes, Bridget gazed at the distant snow-covered parapets.
On a shoulder of one of the peaks, I think. Sky Dog, do you know?
I've never seen it.
So you don't know what it's supposed to be either?
I really don't think it matters. Stones, stars, the directions, time, these can speak to us out of the silent past. Sometimes their language is intuitive, spiritual, and the meanings will be felt by the sensitive, but can't really be communicated by your dead pre-dark science.
Sometimes that's true, and sometimes scientists, rather than shamans, can hear the cosmos speak, and they can hear it through various scientific disciplines. What shamans think may have been lost in the mists of time can be found again through science.
Speaking of dead pre-dark science, if there is a cog facility inside the mountain, do you think it'll have a gateway?
I really couldn't say. Not even Lakesh knows how many of the modular Mattrans units were built or where they were shipped to.
Kane wasn't surprised by her answer. 200 years ago, after Lakesh had debugged the gateway system, the Cerberus Redoubt became, from the end of one millennium to the beginning of another, a manufacturing facility. The quantum interface Mattrans inducers, known colloquially as gateways, were built in modular form and shipped to other redoubts and installations. In the 5 years preceding the new cost, the gateway system, the Cerberus network, had been set up all over the globe. By then, even the totality concept itself had begun to schism along faction lines. Certain project personnel decided to hedge their bets, putting gateways in places other groups didn't know about to further their own partisan agendas. Kane led the six people down the opposite side of the escarpment and into the rugged terrain of the valley. As they walked across it, he tried to listen for sounds, but he heard very little. Visually, he searched the boulders they would have to pass, moving his gaze slowly around and between them. There was a sudden, subtle shift in the atmosphere. He couldn't explain it, yet his point man sense reacted to it. If he had been a true wolf, his hackles would have bristled and he would have tucked his tail under his belly. The sun was unchanged, its brightness undiminished. A haze lay across the outcroppings, butting up against the foot of Medicine Mountain, but he sensed a difference in the brush-snarled area they approached. Bridget moved up close beside him.
What's wrong, Kane?
I wish I knew. I only know that something's out of tune.
Bridget drew her own auto pistol as they made their way closer to the edge of the valley. Kane suddenly rocked to a halt, gesturing for his companions to do the same.
What is it?
I don't know.
Something scares the trickster wolf?
Yes, something scares the trickster wolf. A man of your age ought to know that sometimes you have to be smart to be scared.
What scares you here?
Everything. Nothing.
There's not even a lizard.
There's another thing that bothers me. Let's find another way out of here.
We're almost out now.
Just humor me.
Like that's a new thing.
They began backtracking, the kit foxes obviously unhappy.
The Lynx soldiers!
Kane resisted the urge to ask him who was scared now. Instead, the Sin Eater slapped into his hand, and he kept his eyes on the border of trees and undergrowth.
Run, I'll cover you.
A multitude of small canisters burst open against the ground.
Gas canisters, drop!
Clouds of vapor spread across the area. A tart chemical sting burned Kane's nostrils, and he immediately held his breath and slitted his eyes. Through a part in the undergrowth poured a column of dun-attired men, all of them armed with spidery, long-barreled rifles. Their faces were turned into something inhuman and insectoid by gas masks. The canopy of drifting gas obscured their numbers, but Kane guessed there were at least a dozen. The pall of vapor made it impossible for him or his two partners to fire their weapons with any degree of accuracy. Rather than expend their limited ammunition, they adopted the first course of action that occurred to them. They rose and began running. Only the realization that the uniformed men apparently preferred to take the six people alive kept Kane from going to ground and shooting it out. Still, he lingered for a few moments, firing random shots at the uniformed men to buy his companions a little time. Bridget, Grant, Skydog, and the Kit Foxes scattered, sprinting in different directions to confuse and confound the millennialists. Kane got to his feet and started running through the plains of vapor. The chemical fog seared his eyes, lungs, and nostrils. After he inhaled a whiff of it, the world darkened and teetered around him. He fought against the blackness, conscious of a lancing pain in his skull that bored through both temples. Absently, Kane realized the gas, delivered by scatterpack launchers, was not of the CS variety, nor an opiate, but some kind of nerve agent. He had no idea of its full effects, nor did he care to find out. Fixing his gaze on a tall blue spruce on the opposite side of the valley, Kane ran headlong as fast as he could. He inhaled lungful after lungful of fresh air, and the pain in his head abated a bit, and the darkness creeping in on the edge of his vision receded. Still, the skin between his shoulder blades itched in anticipation of a bullet drilling into his flesh. The toe of his right boot struck an object at ground level, and he fell heavily, barely able to catch himself on his hands. Pitching around, he saw one of the Lakota lying sprawled face down, arms flung out, legs twisted. Clutching him by the shoulder of his buckskin tunic, Kane carefully turned him over. Despite the dirt and smeared war paint on his face, the features of Bear in the Woods were easily recognizable. The warrior's eyes were half open, but they were dull and lusterless. Spittle drooled from the corners of his mouth. He breathed rapidly, his chest rising and falling spasmodically, but Kane didn't think he was suffering from the effects of the neurogen. Then he saw the small, metal-walled dart protruding from the side of Bear's neck. Recognizing the sound now, Kane hurled himself to one side, rolling up onto his right knee as a twin of the hypodermic dart that had felled Bear buried itself in the ground an inch from his foot. A gas-masked millennialist, scarcely discernible in the wafting vapors, stood behind a four-foot-high boulder, less than 50 feet away, a spindly rifle at his shoulder. Without hesitation, Kane squeezed off a single round from his sin-eater, knocking the man over. Rising to his feet, Kane began running again. Kane zigzagged, running broken field style, although he doubted one of the darts could penetrate his shadow suit. Despite what he heard, Kane could neither see either a wildcat or a horse. Even as he sprinted, he wondered why the millennialists apparently wanted them incapacitated and not dead. The attackers on the river had displayed no such merciful tendencies. He guessed the situation had changed, but he couldn't imagine why or how. Kane's lungs burned with the sustained effort of trying to run as fast as he could while breathing in short, swift gasps. He made it to the spruce tree, and a consortium operative stepped out from behind it, holding one of the long-barreled tranquilizer rifles. He dug in his heels and dodged to the right, raising his sin-eater at the same time. An exquisitely sharp, wicked pain stabbed through the left side of his neck, just beneath the hinge of his jaw, where it wasn't protected by the high collar of his shadow suit. Kane's finger jerked in reflexive reaction on the trigger. The millennialist clapped a hand over his right thigh and staggered back. As Kane pivoted on his toes, his auto pistol quested for another target. At least, that was what his instincts told his body to do. Instead, he achieved a kind of stumble-footed quarter turn, and he leaned against the tree. Kane's arms and legs suddenly felt as if they were hollow straws being pumped full of half-frozen mud. The fingers of his left hand explored the side of his neck, found the metal hypodermic dart there, and pinched it away. He aimed the sin-eater at the man writhing on the ground, clutching at the blood-pulsing wound in his right thigh. His finger tightened on the trigger, or he thought it did. His finger remained stiff and straight. His mind sent frantic messages to his hands. Squeeze! Pull! Squeeze! He stared incredulously at the sin-eater. His limbs could move, sluggishly and laboriously, but not his extremities. His fingers and toes were numb, as if they had been amputated. When the millennialist saw Kane couldn't squeeze the trigger, he didn't crawl away. Elbowing himself up to a half-sitting position, he fumbled with his rifle, breaking it open and using a thumb to insert a needle-tipped dart into the chamber. Kane was afraid to try to take cover behind the tree. If he fell down in the process and couldn't get up, the man could literally pincushion him with the trank darts while he lay there helpless. Shoving himself away from the tree trunk, Kane took two shambling steps forward and let himself drop atop the consortium agent. Powered by 185 pounds of virtually dead weight, the man stopped moving, his limbs going slack. Kane struggled atop the man's body, managing to get to his hands and knees. Alerted by movement in his peripheral vision, he pushed himself, swaying, to his knees. He waved his pistol menacingly, but he realized he probably looked like a belligerent but ultimately incompetent drunk to the four millennialists converging around him. They spied their companion lying unconscious and bleeding on the ground.
You motherfucker!
A heavy-soled combat boot pounded into Kane's right ribcage. He sprawled onto his side, the sin-eater leaving his nerveless hands, vanishing from sight in a clump of high grass. Breath knocked out of him from the impact, Kane tried to force himself to his knees again. Through the amoeba-shaped floater swimming across his vision, he glimpsed the hollow bore of a trank gun aimed at his face.
No!
Suddenly, Grant smashed full tilt into the men, shoulder slamming them aside, wresting the rifles out of their hands. His teeth bared in fury, Grant's left leg arced up, his foot burying itself in a millennialist's crotch. As the man went down, Grant whirled on another just as he launched a roundhouse kick at him. As the Millennialist's boots snapped toward his belly, Grant's hands came together, catching the ankle and twisting savagely. The Consortium agent spun in the direction of the twist, and when Grant released him, he hit the ground full length with such force, dust puffed up around his body. The other two men recovered their trank guns and fired darts at Grant, but they stuck in his jacket, failing to penetrate the shadow suit beneath. In response, he unslung his copperhead and squeezed the trigger, holding it down. The subgun stuttered. Then bright streamers of blood splashed from the series of holes punched through the man's chest. Loose-limbed, he toppled to the ground. At the same time, the surviving Millennialist dropped his trank rifle and drew a spike-nosed auto pistol from a holster at the small of his back. He took swift aim at Grant, just as a .45 caliber round crashed into the occipital region of the man's head. The impact of the slug drove him forward, the broad cranial bone at his hairline breaking open and popping the lenses out of his gas mask. Holding her TP-9 in a double-fisted grip, Bridget strode into view. Although Kane felt a surge of both relief and gratitude at the sight of her, he also experienced a queasy sensation of dread at her paleness and the perspiration beating her forehead. Even Grant looked distinctly unwell, his lips grayish, his face gleaming with a film of clammy sweat. Reaching down, Grant secured a grip on Kane's right arm and tried to lift him to his feet, but it wasn't easy. The numbness had spread further through Kane's legs, making his knees feel as if they had been replaced by jelly. Bridget stepped up and helped Grant haul Kane to his feet.
It's that damn gas. It doesn't work as fast as the darts, but even brief exposure works on you eventually. It's probably a diluted derivative of VX. The symptoms seem similar. Our shadow suits provided us protection from the full effects.
Kane grimaced as he tried to stand on ankles that felt rubbery.
I guess the idea is the gas slows you up enough to get tranked.
Seems that way. Let's get out of sight.
Slinging his arms over their shoulders, Bridget and Grant half-dragged Kane through a hedgerow of undergrowth into a boulder-strewn, sparsely-treed field that led toward a line of cliffs about a mile ahead. For half the distance, the ground was level and covered with waist-high grass and weeds. A narrow trail, little wider than a deer path, threaded among the grasses and intersected with a house-sized rock formation 100 feet ahead.
That place looks defensible. Nobody can sneak up on us. We'll hole up there and get this gas and juice out of our systems. Then we can plan our next moves.
Anybody see Sky Dog?
No. Came across Bear in the woods. He'd been tranked. But if the Lynx soldiers are around and they spot Sky Dog...
There's not much we can do to help him in the shape we're in.
Suddenly, she broke off and Kane saw the quick flash of alarm in her eyes. Sweeping around both sides of the rock formation came a troop of horses. Kane caught only glimpses of the near-naked female figures astride them. Kane recognized Catamount in the lead, leaning over her black mare's neck, teeth bared in either a grimace of determination or a grin of delight, her cape of panther pelt streaming behind her. Galloping hooves kicked dirt clods high in the air as the Lynx soldiers bore down on them. Grant tried to bring up his copperhead, but he was hampered by Kane's weight. The flank of a horse clipped him and both men went down heavily, Grant sprawling atop Kane. Bridget raised her TP-9, trying to achieve target acquisition on the nearest of the women, but as the horse swept by, the haft of a long, feathered lance struck the nerve ganglia atop her right shoulder and she fell, banging her knees on rocks. Her arm went completely numb. Twisting, she looked behind her. Catamount charged forward, a long-plated whip inscribing a humming, hazy circle in the air over her head. Bridget transferred her pistol from her right to her left hand and raised it, finger curling around the trigger. The whip snaked around Bridget's left forearm, a streak of fire across her wrist. She dropped her pistol and she clawed at the whip, staggering as Catamount galloped past, the length of oiled braided rawhide stretching taut. Rather than risk a dislocated elbow joint, Bridget didn't resist the pull. She went with it, kicking herself forward, but she lost her balance, tripped, and fell. Dragged along on her belly, she disappeared among the high grasses. The mounted Lynx soldiers pounded on past Grant and Kane, who were struggling to their feet, then turned their mounts expertly. They charged back and dismounted in graceful vaulting leaps, piling atop the two men, bringing them down again.
Shit!
Kane slammed a fist into a flat belly, brought up a knee, then planted an elbow under himself and almost gained his hands and knees with at least three Lynx soldiers clinging to him. Then a very hard object cracked against the back of his skull. Pinwheels of light spun behind his eyes, but he didn't lose consciousness. Reeling, Kane tore one arm free and tried to swing a blow from the shoulder, but he couldn't force his mind and body to work in tandem. A deerskin shod foot slammed up between his legs. The shadow suit had a reinforced cup made of quadruple layers of monochrysan spectra in the crotch, but the impact was still transmitted to his groin. Without it, his testicles would have caught in his throat. Kane stumbled, sick and dizzy. He caught a blurry impression of Grant going down under the butts of lances. Then he collapsed face first into the dust and lay there, unable to move. Kane lifted his head. It took an eternity. He glimpsed Catamount on her mare, and once more she reminded him irresistibly of a Valkyrie. But this time, it was because she carried on the saddle blanket before her, not the soul of a slain warrior, but Bridget Baptiste. Her wrists were bound behind her by stout thongs, and her face hidden under the veil of her red-gold hair. Catamount rode away, the other Lynx soldiers following her on their own horses. The tawny shape of Deathmaw loped alongside the black mare, his muzzle darkened and glistening with fresh blood. Kane fought to push himself upward, his mind racing, although his body seemed somewhere else. He strained to regain control of his body, arms and legs flopping like fish stranded on dry land, but the effort exhausted him. He was immobilized. He tried to call out to Grant, but he couldn't force a sound past his lips. His throat felt swollen, closed. He tried to brace himself with his hands, but he couldn't feel them, and he was sure he hadn't the coordination to spit, much less stand up. Then the world darkened around him, shutting out everything but anger and humiliation, and they spun like enraged hornets within the walls of his mind.